from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Ross Reynolds. This is The Conversation. The National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence reports that in the United States, over 23 million people over the age of 12 are addicted to alcohol or other drugs. Not only that, a recent Columbia University study found that only 1 in 10 of these people seeks treatment for drug addiction. And most of the time, even when they do, the treatment does not work. Well, today we'd like to talk about what does work. How did you get sober?
My name is Tim. I used to be a homeless drug addict, methamphetamine user, cocaine user, and alcoholic. And I don't have to do that anymore. And how did I get sober? Gosh, it took a long time. It's the hardest thing I've ever done. And I don't ever want to go back.
Hi, my name's Nick. I live in Olympia. I've been sober for a little over 4 years now. I was drinking every day. I couldn't really count sober days. And I was fairly young. I mean, I'm 27 now.
My name is Henry G, and I used to be one of those guys that you would see up on Capitol Hill on Broadway with the spikes and the pokey hair and the tattoos. And I was using and drinking for about 24 years, and I got sober through a 12-step program 3 years ago. It was the last thing I wanted to do. I kept on trying over and over. And then I finally just woke up one morning, and I went to a meeting, and my life has been awesome since then.
How did you get sober? 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-KUOW. That's what some folks told us earlier today. If you're outside our area, it's a toll-free number, 800-289-5869. With us in the studio, Dr. Jim Walsh, the medical director of addiction recovery services at Swedish Medical Center in Ballard. He just returned from Chicago, where he attended a conference held by the American Society of Addiction Medicine. Dr. Walsh, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Russ.
Any headlines out of that conference? Anything new to report on addiction science?
I think the big initiative now is an effort to bring addiction treatment into the mainstream of American medicine. And traditionally, addiction services were provided either in community support groups, as you heard, sometimes family or church-based groups, and a variety of treatments that have been outside of the medical system. And people don't know that they can ask their doctor for help, and there's things that a physician can do. So that's kind of the big social push.
We think of drug addiction with heroin or cocaine or meth, but I understand there's a rising problem, perhaps even a greater problem, from prescription drug addiction.
Opiate dependence has been one of the dominant trends, particularly here in the state of Washington. The sense is that the liberal prescription uses has led that field, although there's a lot of illicit prescription opiate pills as well.
Is there any difference between drug addiction and alcohol addiction?
The different substances, whether they're alcohol or opiates or cocaine or methamphetamine, have different patterns and different morbidities. But the process by how people become dependent is really quite similar.
You know, these numbers I read at the beginning, kind of depressing. 23 million people, only 1 in 10 seek treatment, and a lot of times it doesn't work. But over time, is that worse than we've done in the past, better, about the same?
I think quite similar. Addiction is a problem in society. It typically affects 10% of people on a lifetime prevalence basis, which means that 10% of people might be actively using or might be in recovery or have stopped at this point. That hasn't really changed much over time. The different drugs that are used kind of change generationally or sort of by decade, but the incidence of addiction in general tends to hold pretty steady.
What leads to drug and alcohol addiction? What causes it?
That is a matter of great debate. We know that some people are genetically more predisposed to it. People tend to make an assumption that reflects personality characteristics. The best evidence we have is that for most of us, when we use substances, we become quite uncomfortable. For example, if you drink too heavily, you might feel very sick the next day. People who have a genetic propensity to alcoholism often don't feel sick the next day. They're the people who can hold their liquor, as it were. With opiates, we see the same pattern. A lot of people find opiates quite dysphoric, but a portion of the population doesn't have that experience at all.
So that's kind of might be the genetic part of it. What about nature? How does nature influence us to become or not become dependent on alcohol or drugs?
Well, it certainly takes exposure to a substance to develop dependence. I mean, dependence is a process of becoming your nervous system becoming used to the substance being there. So certainly you have to try it first and use it regularly. If people didn't have initial exposure, that wouldn't happen. There's been a lot of thought about personality characteristics that predispose people to be more likely to try things or less likely to try things, as well as environmental or social things, cultural things that can affect it. A classic example is with cigarettes. As the price of cigarettes goes up, the incidence of becoming addicted to nicotine goes down. down because the barrier to developing regular use goes up.
If there's people in your family that have addiction problems, are you more likely to have addiction problems?
Significantly more likely. It's even been shown that for adoptive children are more prone to follow their genetic parents' pattern of use than their adoptive parents.
You know, we're going to be talking more about getting sober, mm-hmm. but knowing a little bit about what causes it, do we know how to prevent it? If someone has risk factors genetically or in their family, is there some way they can prepare themselves to not fall into this?
Yeah, being aware of it's really helpful. People often will perceive themselves experiencing an early loss of control, and if they know that that's a real risk, if they've learned about it from their parents, for example, they may be more less likely to go down that road. Sometimes it feels like certain addictions have an alternation of generations because you learn about your parents, but you don't learn about what happened with your grandparents.
I was really surprised at this figure that many people, only 1 in 10 people who are addicted, are seeking treatment. Why is that?
There's different reasons. There are people who are early in their process, don't want to quit. There are people who are really committed to quitting on their own, which is a really powerful idea for people, even when it's not working. But I'd say one of the biggest problems is that it's scary to seek treatment. If I asked any one of us in this room to go to rehab and leave your work for a month and go off to a rehab center, that sounds really frightening. Finding ways to offer treatment in a way that helps people kind of lower their fear factor would be a really important thing.
What's the line between someone who's using drugs recreationally or drinking now and again to someone who's addicted? How do you know you've crossed that line?
The way it's defined medically in the current DSM is that it really has to focus on loss of control. If you identify the substance as a problem for you, if you feel like you shouldn't use it at all or you shouldn't use as much, and yet you're unable to lower your use or stop your use, that demonstrates that loss of control.
And I want to talk in a little bit about what are called high-functioning alcoholics or drug addicts who seem to be able to keep it together even though they've got this going on. We're talking about people who've kicked alcohol or drugs or have become sober. It's a lifelong process. 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-KUOW. Toll-free 800-289-5869. Write to us, conversation@KUOW.org. Daniel's on the line, and Daniel kicked his addiction on his own. Daniel, tell us a little bit about what you were addicted to and how you got into it in the first place.
Yeah, thanks for having me. My main addiction, as it were, I would say would be meth and kind of a mix of meth and cocaine. I got started pretty early at the age of 17. I was introduced to it by by a family member. And it was more of a way just to fuel me through my day as I worked as a bricklayer. And I became extremely dependent upon it just to, you know, get me through the day. And if anyone, you know, knows how methamphetamine works, it pretty much keeps you awake and it keeps you from, you know, being able to really produce, you know, any kind of real quality work, but you feel like you can't do anything without it.
Hmm.
You know, after a lot of trials with it and being put in the hospital, and I had a heart attack with it, and it still wouldn't, I couldn't stop it. I just was able to do it on my own, and I don't know where that power came from. I wish I did, because then I could share it more with people.
Maybe you could describe that process, like what, when you finally realized this is something I have to stop, was that the first time you'd realized it?
The first few times that, you know, I found myself in a hospital, it never even dawned on me that I would be stopping. It was sort of it was just like, well, this is an inconvenience in my drug schedule. But when I really knew I needed to stop was, you know, after a second heart attack, a doctor just looked at me and said, you won't survive this.
How old were you at the time when you had your second heart attack, Dan?
17.
Wow.
Still 17. It was pretty much a year binge of just pretty much every day.
How was the How was the detox process? What was that like?
Miserable. Yeah, it was months. It took months to even get out of bed, much less, you know, perform as a human being. And it was miserable. And it was, you know, it just before I could even walk. I mean, I'd had a very serious heart condition, and it put me in bed for months. I couldn't walk. I could barely even get up and go take a shower by myself or anything. It was pretty miserable.
How old are you now, Daniel?
Good question. I'm 37.
37, and this was this, you kind of went through this when you were 17, so you've been sober some time.
Yeah, and honestly, I never really did look back. I sort of felt like I got through that, and that was it for me.
You're,
I never really had to go back to it.
You're probably talking to some people who might be going through right now what you went through when you were 17. What's your advice for them? What would you say to them?
Well, I tell you, what I would say to them would be to just look at what you have to lose. And no matter how bad off you are, you do have something to lose. You have friends, you have family, you have loved ones, people that love you. And there's always something to lose. And I know that's what drove me. And and you may have to dig really deep for it. You may have to, you know, spend some time looking around and saying, like, well, you know, what does the future have for me? What can I do as a human being, in this world? And what have I not seen yet? What have I not experienced yet? And you know, especially something like meth and cocaine, that you will never see or experience those things if you let that take control of your life.
Hey, Daniel, we really appreciate you taking the time to share your story with us today.
Of course.
Dr. Jim Walsh is in the studio with me, Medical Director of Addiction Recovery Services at Swedish Medical Center's Ballard campus. How typical is Daniel's story? It sounds as though he described it as a year-long binge, and he also described he got off it himself. He did it on his own. How typical is that?
It's hard to say, because for those of us who work in treatment, you by definition don't encounter that. When they do population studies, it's clearly a lot of people are able to mature out of periods of substance use. I suspect that's more true with stimulants than alcohol, for example, where use tends to start later. But I think there's a lot of people who stop. But on their own is a complicated statement. My suspicion is that Daniel had support of the medical community, probably his family. He spoke so much about his family and friends. Having supportive people who are not using, people who know what's happening and hope the best for you, is a really powerful thing. And that can happen at a recovery meeting, a 12-step meeting. For some of us, that can happen in a family encounter or in a church situation or with a clinician.
Are there particular approaches to recovery that work better with methamphetamines?
I think that's true. I mean, as a physician, I deal a lot with the pharmacologic treatment of substances, and those have not been effective for methamphetamine and cocaine. So social and community changes are really important, building a supportive group of people around you. For a lot of people, stimulant use is a social event, sometimes related to sexual activity or dating activity. Changing the people that you associate with is really going to be a really important step.
Let's go to Diane. She's listening to us today in Ballard. And Diane, I understand you got sober.
Yes, I did, and thank you so much for this program. I hope next time it's at least an hour. But I got sober through AA, first of all, though. Life consequences, my life was unmanageable. Actually walked drunk across the Ballard Bridge, thought about jumping off, and the next day was April Fool's Day. And the irony just, I love it. I said to myself, you'd be a fool to drink again. And I have 7 years of sobriety this April.
Congratulations.
Thanks to AA. And I actually, Max, an addiction counselor at Ballard Swedish, interviewed me and recommended outpatient treatment at Milam. And in the Milam program, they require 3 times a week at AA. I go every day now. I have 7 years of sobriety. And they say it's the largest club in the world that nobody wants to be a member of. Hmm. But then we start looking forward to it. We laugh, we cry. It's two alcohols talking to each other. That's how Bill and Bob started it many years ago. I recommend that people watch the Bill Wilson story. And also I want to say that the debate about is it a disease or not, I don't care. It's a fact that I'm an alcoholic. I've turned from a cucumber into a pickle. I can never go back to a cucumber. I've accepted it. I'm not ashamed of it. And I just, believe it or not, some of us call that we're grateful alcoholics, because we enter a whole realm of this support group. And,
yeah,
you know, stopping drinking is just the first step, and we learn how to have productive, joyous, happy, joyous, and free lives.
Diane, thank you so much for your call and sharing that with us. And for her, AA worked. But there's a Columbia University study that says most people who seek treatment don't get evidence-based care. And this has been a big criticism, and we heard it from David Sheff, who wrote about this, saying that, you know, there's just too many people out there saying they can help folks, but there's no evidence demonstrating that they can. Do you find that to be true?
It is true, although that's not unusual in some other parts of medicine as well. Evidence to prove the efficacy of something is often very challenging. If you think about how AA meetings work, we know that people who are more likely to go are much more likely to stay sober. At the same time, you really can't do a randomized controlled trial of assigning people to AA meetings or placebo AA meetings. There wouldn't be any such thing. There have been some treatment programs that have been well organized, that have been grant funded, and that go to enormous lengths to prove the validity of the effect. And that's really exciting to have that information, and certainly want to promote those therapies. It's difficult to say that other things are not effective because they're not necessarily proven to be effective, and that's one of the challenges.
Finally, is there any correlation between recognizing a problem relatively early in the period of being addicted versus waiting longer? Is there more of a success rate if like our first caller, Daniel, you do something like within a year of your first really taking your big fall?
Yeah, there's different perspectives for that. You know, the development of that loss of control, both the physical dependence and the social impact, happens over a period of time. And starting with alcohol, there's a lot of evidence that early intervention can actually prevent people but developing alcoholism. And intervention basically in the sense of talking to people and pointing out the possibility of that happening. On the other hand, with some treatments, it does appear that the clarity, as these two callers had, about how bad it's been for them helps them open up to significant changes.
Let's bring into the conversation Rebecca Mullen, who grew up and currently lives in Seattle. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us to tell your story.
Thanks for having me.
You went into an outpatient program when you decided that you were going to quit. What did that involve?
It was a 7-month program. 2 months was what they called intensive care, and that was meeting 3 times a week on Thursdays and Friday nights and Saturday afternoons for a couple hours each session. And after that 2-month initial intensive portion was what they called continuing care, and that was when we met once a week for the next 5 months. And I sought out an outpatient program because I would have considered myself a high-functioning drinker, and I was not comfortable with, you know, putting my life on hold for 30 days to enter an inpatient. I wanted something that I could do and continue my job and my life.
When you say you were high-functioning, Rebecca, what do you mean by that?
I had a job. I never, you know, missed my job because of drinking. I had never gotten in trouble with the law. I had not, up until that point ruined any relationships, although, as I became sober, I realized that a lot of my relationships had been suffering because of my alcohol use. But there was no glaring moment or portion of my life that had become unmanageable.
So when did why did the light go on then? If you were functioning, what all of a sudden made you decide, I need to get some help here? I need to go to an outpatient clinic. I need to do something.
Sure. Well, I was engaged to a recovering alcoholic himself. He had been sober for a couple years, and it became very clear to me, with the help of some conversations with my family and with my fiance, that it really wasn't going to be acceptable for me to continue to drink the way I was drinking, to be a part of a relationship with someone who himself was sober. And I valued that relationship a lot more than I valued my drinking. So that, that was sort of the impetus.
Rebecca, how long have you been sober?
2.5 years.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you for telling us your story. Rebecca Mullen, finally, I want to go back to this question of the high-functioning alcoholic or drug addict. It seems like if things appear to be going okay, you're not demonstrably ruining your life, or perhaps, although it was interesting to hear her say that looking back, she realized that this did have an effect. What prompts someone who's a high-functioning alcoholic or drug addict to actually seek treatment?
When the phrase high-functioning is usually used for people who maintain their employment, and obviously employment's a really important thing, but parenting and marital relationships are obviously critical to our sense of well-being in the long run, and it's almost inevitably true when people are drinking or using substances to that degree, there's going to be significant impact on those relationships.
And particularly parenting, I would think.
Sure.
Hard to keep it together if you're not impaired as a parent.
Well, there's certainly lots of people who succeed in feeding and clothing and keeping the kids healthy, but it's hard to role model and be that calm presence that you'd want to be in all your relationships.
Dr. Jim Walsh, thank you so much for coming by. I appreciate it. And I'm going to take the advice of that caller. We should spend more time on this next time we talk about it. Dr. Walsh, Medical Director of Addiction Recovery Services at Swedish Medical Center's Ballard Campus. From KUOW, I'm Ross Reynolds.